Okay, I think we're going to start off on this roundtable discussion that we've got here today. For those of you who haven't been to LSC Ideas before, I'd like to extend a warm welcome to the centre. It is the LSC Centre for Diplomacy and Strategy that aims to marry academia with current affairs practitioners, but also to look at international affairs from a past and a present perspective. This is the first of the Latin America International Affairs Programme's events for 2010. I'm sorry about the lack of space at the back there. The big turnout is a positive sign. We will try and get a bigger room next time. Today, it's given me great honour to chair a roundtable discussion on the US-Colombian bases agreement that was signed late last year. I say discussion rather than debate. I mean, obviously, there has been quite a lot of debate on the agreement. The idea behind organising this discussion was to provide a forum for intelligent, informed, reasoned exchange of views on the agreement. And interestingly as well, to receive your comments and questions on the subject. We're very, very happy to have the Colombian ambassador, Mauricio Rodriguez, here today to give an authoritative perspective and also very kindly to answer any questions that you might have. I've personally got the easy job as the chair, but I've got three informed speakers on my left and my right. On my left, Spencer Wood, a partner at OH Parsons Trade Union Solicitors, who recently visited Colombia as part of a UK parliamentary and trade union delegation. On my right, we have Liam Craig-Best, Director of Justice for Colombia, an NGO campaigning for improved rights and social conditions for the people of Colombia. And to my right further along is Grace Livingston, author of a recent book, America's Backyard, and also a journalist who's worked for The Guardian, the BBC World Service, and others before. I think we're going to go in reverse order, from right to left here. And speakers are going to have about 15 minutes to kind of talk briefly, introduce some of the key points we're looking to address, particularly the significance of the agreement for international affairs of the region and for Colombia itself. And then I'm going to open up for questions after that. So, Grace, would you like to start?
Well, thanks very much for inviting me. I was going to talk mainly about the agreement from a US perspective, and in particular a US military perspective. Because as you know, when the deal was announced, it caused a great stir in Latin America. And the State Department rushed to reassure Colombia's neighbours that this was only about maintaining security within Colombia and wouldn't affect neighbouring countries. Hillary Clinton, for example, said, "This agreement does not pertain to other countries. It's about the bilateral cooperation between the United States and Colombia regarding security matters within Colombia." But not long after this, some Colombian journalists noticed that a document written by the US Air Force had been sent to Congress months earlier. And this document, it was a budget justification, and it asked Congress for over $40 million to expand the capacity of one of the Colombian bases, Palanquero Air Base. And the document appeared to show that the Pentagon had far wider objectives than it was publicly admitting. It said Palanquero provides an opportunity for conducting full spectrum operations throughout South America. And full spectrum is a Pentagon jargon for dominating the battle space on land, sea, air, and space itself. And it goes on to say, development of this base provides a unique opportunity for full spectrum operations in a critical sub-region of our hemisphere, where security and stability is under constant threat from narcotics-funded terrorist insurgencies, anti-US governments, endemic poverty, and recurring natural disasters. And of course, that phrase, anti-US governments, was the one that alarmed Colombia's neighbours. And the document appeared to many Latin American countries to confirm suspicions that this deal was really about maintaining a US military hegemony in the region, and perhaps maintaining its ability to interfere in the affairs of other nations. Now, if you speak to US officials, they downplay the significance of this document, and the offending text was deleted. It wasn't delete it before it was passed through Congress. And I, for example, spoke to one former Pentagon official, he's now a military academic, and he agreed that this document was very much overplayed. He said it was probably written by a mid-level Pentagon bureaucrat who was trying to exaggerate the potential of Palanquero in order to win congressional funds. And then he added, well, this is what, you know, Pentagon planners do. They play war games, they strategize about their military assets around the world. So even if we accept that argument, I think that document does show that the Pentagon has at least considered the strategic value of these Colombian bases for its own regional and perhaps global operations. And that analysis is also confirmed by another document written by the Air Force, this time a think paper, and that was prepared for a conference organised by the US Air Force. And this document was brought up in a UNISOR conference. Chavez quoted from it extensively, and UNISOR agreed to have a closer look at it. And it's called the White Paper, Air Mobility Command, Global En Route Strategy. And basically it shows how Palanquero slots into a worldwide network of bases, air bases that the US Air Force could use to have, quote, global access to areas of strategic interest. So again, I mean, this one is only an academic paper. It didn't even get sent to Congress. And I'm not by any means suggesting that these papers prove that the US is intending to interfere in the affairs of other countries or has any plans to invade any other countries or anything like that. But I do think they show that the Pentagon is considering the strategic value of these bases and is considering them as military assets in its regional and possibly global operations. So what I'm going to do now, I'm sorry this map is so small. It doesn't really matter if you can't actually see it, because I'm going to explain what's on it. But basically give you an overview of the US military presence in Latin America and how the Colombian bases slot into it. As you probably know, US Southern Command used to be based in the Panama Canal Zone. In 1997, it moved its headquarters to Miami, and in 1999, all US troops left Panama. Since then, the US has been reliant on friendly governments to lend or lease it military facilities. In 1999, it signed four leases for the use of air bases, 10-year leases, with Aruba and Curaçao, El Salvador and Ecuador there. As you probably know, again, President Correa, the left-wing president, decided not to extend the lease when it expired last year, and US forces left Manta last year. El Salvador is quite interesting because the lease on that base was extended for a further 5 years just before President Funes was inaugurated, so he wasn't given the opportunity to ask US forces to leave should he have wanted to. But you can imagine that the Pentagon might be unsure about the long-term future of the base in El Salvador. Now, the loss of Manta was a blow to the US because, as you can see, it was the only air base in South America. The others were all in Central America or the Caribbean. And this is where the Colombian agreement comes in. I've got another map, which is even smaller. I'll try and make it a bit bigger. I've actually borrowed this from The Economist. As you can see, he slightly adapted it. The Colombian agreement gives the US the right to use seven named bases. We have two naval bases, Malaga and Cartagena, which gives the US access to both the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans, which could be important for its global operations. Three air bases, Palanquero, Apiaia, and Malambo. As I said before, Palanquero is the most important. It will have the capacity to for very large aircraft, C-17s, to land enormous troop carriers, and that's what has particularly concerned other countries. And two army bases, Larandi and Tolomeda. Now, the differences with Manta is, one, the greatly expanded presence. Manta was only one base. This is obviously seven bases. And the US is now talking about Colombia as a hub of operations in the hemisphere. And the remit is also far wider. In Manta, US forces were confined to counter-narcotics operations. In this agreement, I mean, it's incredibly broad. In the DCA, the official agreement, it says that the bases will be used in order to address common threats to peace, stability, freedom and democracy. So really the parameters are so wide it could, you know, encompass anything from counter-narcotics, counter-insurgency, or, you know, possibly actions against anti-US governments. It's so broad it doesn't really limit it in any way. The US says the cap on US forces that currently exist will stay in place. That's 800 soldiers and 600 civilians. But this could change in the future, and there's actually no cap on the number of forces in this latest agreement, the DCA. Neither is there a limit on the number of bases that US forces can use. They can use as many military facilities or bases as they like with the agreement of the Colombian government. And just a final point to make is that the US have actually been present on many of these bases for a long time. Since the launch of Plan Colombia in 2000, the US has gradually been sucked into not just the counter-narcotics war, but the counter-insurgency war. And so I've added on the map a couple of bases where NGOs actually have noted US presence there. There's Esquinas down in sort of FARC-dominated area, Arauca up there near the border with Venezuela. Now, the agreement does have a non-intervention clause. It says the parties shall comply with their obligations under this agreement in a manner consistent with the principles of sovereign equality, territorial integrity of states, and non-intervention in the internal affairs of other states. However, many South American countries are still very unhappy. They don't think that's worded strongly enough. Brazil and Argentina, for example, issued a very strongly worded statement even after they'd seen this agreement, and they said that the presence of a military base of an extra-regional power is a situation incompatible with the principles for respect of sovereignty and territorial integrity of states within the region. And in fact, most South American governments have expressed some concern. Venezuela, Bolivia, Ecuador, as you might expect, the left-wing governments, but also Uruguay, Paraguay, Chile, that may change now after the elections. One final thing to say about the agreement is, in fact, most of the text concentrates on what taxes the US won't have to pay. So they won't have to pay road tolls, overflight or landing fees, harbour fees, entry or departure fees, import taxes. They don't need licences to construct satellites. Their vehicles and aeroplanes can't be inspected by the Colombian authorities. And as you might expect, their personnel will be immune from criminal prosecution if the Colombian authorities ratify that. I'm not sure if they have or not. So some opposition politicians in Colombia have said, well, perhaps this agreement trespasses on the sovereignty of Colombia itself. I just wanted to point out another few things on the map. I'll go back to that other one, if you can see it. Down here is a base in Paraguay, which was constructed entirely with US money, and it was opened by the US ambassador in 2006. But there's no agreement for US forces to use it, and with the election of President Lugo, it looks very unlikely that there will be. So in some senses, it looks like that's a wasted investment for the Pentagon. And you begin to get a sense that the US is casting around for countries to host its bases, and as many left-wing governments come to power, they're finding it harder and harder to persuade governments to host their forces, and so it's fallen back on Colombia there. Honduras is worth mentioning. This is one of their most important bases. Joint Task Force Bravo is based there. Joint Task Force Bravo. And it's interesting that when John Negroponte was there last year, one of his main concerns about Zelaya was his plans to open up the base to commercial flights, which would obviously compromise the security and secrecy of US operations there. And Negroponte and other hardliners in the US were actually very sympathetic to the coup that took place there. And in my view, that's one of the reasons they're concerned about the long-term future of that base there. I'll just point out the last couple of things. There's about just over 2,000 troops in Puerto Rico. We all know about Guantanamo Bay, where the US has a base at least in perpetuity. And just the other thing of interest are the US also uses a number of airstrips on an ad hoc basis for refueling and minor repairs. Tocumen Airport in Panama is one, and there's a few in Peru, Palma Pampa being one. And the last thing I'll mention on this map is the reactivation of the 4th Fleet of the US Navy. Its operational area is the waters all around Latin America and the Caribbean. And when it was reactivated in 2008, Brazil and Venezuela again expressed concern. So I'm just going to sum up with a few words about Colombia, if that's okay. As we know, Colombia has the worst human rights record in the hemisphere. If you look at the latest report by the UN, the UN Commissioner for Human Rights, it says that, first it says that the FARC is responsible for grave violations of international humanitarian law, the recruitment of minors, of laying of landmines, massacres of civilians, and it says kidnapping is a crime against humanity. It does say that President Uribe has taken steps to strengthen the rule of law, but that violations of human rights by the security forces are still widespread. And in particular, it notes that there's been a rise in extrajudicial executions by the Colombian army. And it says that these extrajudicial executions are widespread and occurring all over the country. It also notes instances of torture and arbitrary detention and ongoing collusion with the paramilitaries. And lastly, on the UN report, something I found very shocking, it says that the recent scandal where a third of Congress is being prosecuted for links to paramilitaries shows the extent of paramilitary infiltration of the state, which I think is quite a shocking phrase for the UN to use. So to sum up, I think the US has been pouring in military aid since the year 2000, and in that period, human rights abuses by the security forces have actually risen. This latest agreement strengthens the military alliance between the US and Colombia. And in my view, that would give Obama less leverage on the question of human rights. And more broadly, the Pentagon has been playing a growing role in shaping US policy. That's true all over the world. But it's particularly the case in Colombia. In 2000, the Southern Command identified Colombia as the most threatened nation in the hemisphere. And so, logically, this had led to an emphasis on military solutions to problems that have social and economic roots. So you can see that with the drugs question, where the US is heavily promoted and funding the spraying of herbicides along with militarized planes. This hasn't led to a fall in coca cultivation. In fact, it's risen in the past two decades by over 500%, according to the State Department's own figures. The price of cocaine has fallen. And why hasn't it worked? Because it doesn't address the roots, the reasons why peasants grow coca, namely they're poor, and when their land is sprayed, they simply move on because they have no alternative. And finally, I don't think there's any easy answers to ending the violence in Colombia, but I think particularly in the countryside, you need to look at these questions of land concentration and land hunger if we're ever Colombia is ever going to end the violence.
Thank you very much. From a more regional, international US perspective, I'm going to hand over to Liam now, who's, I think, going to talk about Colombia.
More about Colombia, yes. There's two principal themes I want to cover this evening. One is why I think the deal is a bad deal for Colombia, why it will do the country more harm than good. And secondly, what I would like to see the Colombian government doing instead. But before I go on to those two points, there's a couple of other issues I want to touch on briefly. One is about the argument about what these bases are going to be. There is a campaign by the Colombian government to suggest, to try and convince people that the new US military presence that Grace has covered is simply an extension of what's been going on for a very long time already. Colombia's Foreign Minister Jaime Bermudez, who last June came out and said there's no changes occurring in the US military presence in Colombia, something which we have to assume he knew at that time wasn't the case. But he's been going around the international capitals pushing this line that there's a natural continuation of US military involvement. But in my eyes, at least, the new bases certainly are clearly different to what's been going on in Colombia with regards to the US military in recent years. And Grace covered the allegations that the aim of the Pentagon is to create a military hub in Colombia. But there are other much more specific changes in the agreement that the agreement will establish with regards to these bases. For example, right now, currently, the US Navy, the US Air Force have a very, very limited presence in Colombia. The new agreement will change that. They'll have a significant presence after this agreement's signed. Right now, it's clear where US military personnel are based in Colombia, what they're doing. But the new agreement will give the US access, and this is in the text of the agreement, to any Colombian airport that they wish. And it will also, and this is a quote from the agreement, give them access to unspecified facilities and locations. And that's a very big change from the current setup. So to sum up on that, I don't think we should believe that this is just a continuation of past arrangements. It's clearly an expansion of US military presence in Colombia. The other very brief points I want to cover before I move on relates to the assurances that these bases that have been given by both Washington and Colombia that these bases will never be used to interfere with Colombia's neighbours. I don't believe the allegations that Washington's building them so they can invade Venezuela or anywhere else. I don't think that's what the plan is. But I do think that we've got to be realistic about it and think about what might happen in the future, because this is a long-term commitment. Whatever assurances are given today by the Obama administration or by the Uribe administration, we don't know what the political climate's going to be in 2012, 2016. And in the future, there'll obviously be policymakers, US policymakers in particular, both in uniform and out of uniform, who will be making decisions about things that we at this time simply can't foresee. And some of those people in the future may be willing to use these bases that will be there by then for other purposes. So I think people need to consider the potential for the misuse of these bases in the future. And the idea of having a President Sarah Palin or a President Jeb Bush deciding how to use these bases to defend US interests in South America is clearly very concerning. But as I said at the start, the main issue I want to look at is why I think that the new base agreement is a bad deal for Colombia. Clearly, the rumours and the allegations that have been flying around South America about what's going to happen about the bases has created tension. But I believe this could have been avoided, this tension, if the issue hadn't been so badly managed and presented by the Uribe administration. The whole process around which the details of the bases emerged demonstrated extremely bad diplomatic skills on the part of the Colombian authorities. That's no criticism of the ambassador here. This is the leadership in Bogota. And the reason I think it was badly managed is that at the beginning, at least, there seemed to be no strategy of engagement explaining to the neighbours or to anyone else, including the Congress of Colombia, what the deal was all about. Instead, there was hyper-secrecy, there were anonymous press leaks and anonymous quotes, and there was a lot of confusion about what the deal exactly composed of. People didn't know. Did it mean masses of US troops in Colombia? They didn't know where the bases would be, what their remit would be, what exactly they'd be used for. And none of these questions were answered at the start, so people were understandably concerned, in particular, obviously, Colombia's neighbours. And I think that the situation developed in this way because Uribe was desperate to shore up his relationship with Washington, President Uribe, and he wanted to bind the two countries as tightly together as he could, almost sort of forcing the Obama administration to be his friend and his number one ally. Because this is something he was obviously concerned about, because Obama has spoken out on several occasions quite forcefully about human rights in Colombia. The free trade agreement between Colombia and the United States is delayed due to human rights concerns. And it's clear from talking to people in Washington that the US agenda is to gradually reduce military aid to Colombia, partly because there's a growing consensus, I think, that the aims and objectives, the crucial objective of destroying the cocaine or reducing the flow of cocaine, the objective of Plan Colombia has simply not been met. So Uribe wanted a sign of goodwill, some sign of goodwill, that would strengthen the alliance and bring the two countries back together, and the bases were the perfect thing for doing that. But the way in which President Uribe handled it backfired, and I think, if anything, it's pushed Washington away. And I understand that there's a lot of people in the US administration who are very pissed off that the way that it was presented, because it inflamed opinion, it increased US anti-US sentiment around the continent. And we have to note that virtually all of the quotes that I mentioned earlier, the unattributed quotes and the ambiguous statements from officials, they came from the Colombian side, not from Washington, not from the Pentagon. So I think that this US anger has been expressed in several ways, in particular their lukewarm support for his diplomatic problems with his neighbours, in particular Venezuela. And that those problems came about, obviously, predominantly because of this arrangement with the bases. The US didn't, as you would expect a natural ally to do, it didn't come to Uribe's aid and give him firm backing. and in reality they've been quite quiet and impartial and sort of distant on this issue. And so when Chavez responded very vigorously to the agreement, the State Department, instead of coming out and taking Uribe's side and supporting Uribe, they basically just said, well, there should be bilateral dialogue, and they acted more as a sort of distant third party than a clear ally and strong ally of Colombia. And additionally, Washington left Uribe to defend this agreement when there was the diplomatic furore around it. They left him to defend it on his own. He had to take a week out and travel around the countries of Latin America listening to the concerns of all the different people there. You didn't see anyone from Washington or the State Department going down and explaining their side of the story. They left it to him. And I think that this cool response from Washington has basically shown just how annoyed they are that President Uribe basically mismanaged this to the extent that it created a regional diplomatic crisis. So in addition to annoying Washington, the first major drawback has obviously been a diplomatic one, and Colombia's diplomatic position on the continent has been negatively affected. It's not just upset the usual suspects like Bolivia and Ecuador and Venezuela, the left-wing governments that Grace mentioned, but also key regional players, obviously the most important one being Brazil. But even to some extent, Uribe's probably closest ally in the region, Alan Garcia in Peru, who came out himself and said he didn't think this was a very good idea either. And the consequences have included Colombia having to pull out of several high-level regional conferences like the UNISUR events late last year, but even also the Latin American Climate Change Conference in Brazil in November, because Lula, President of Brazil, had suggested that the issues of the basis should be on the agenda, so Uribe didn't go. So the new arrangement with the basis had a dramatic impact on Colombia's position in the continent, and it's become quite badly isolated. Another key drawback for Colombia, and one that will have a far greater direct impact on the Colombian people, is the negative effect that this situation has had on trade. Venezuela was Colombia's second largest trading partner until last week when it fell into third place. And this is a direct result of the concerns to do with the basis. Uribe's not been willing to engage seriously with Venezuela, and this has created huge, huge diplomatic problems to the extent where there are difficulties on the border. And this decrease in commerce, and it's been a big decrease, it's going to harm businesses in Colombia and working people in Colombia. And some of you will have seen, who follow the Colombian press this weekend, a big increase in unemployment was announced, and I think that's a direct result of this decrease in commerce. And I think, again, if things had been explained to the neighbours and not done in such a unilateral manner, this situation could have been avoided. But I think the biggest and most critical drawback for Colombia is the effect that the new arrangement will have on the possibilities for peace in Colombia. It's clear that the agreement will result in increased military hardware in Colombia, increased military presence in Colombia, and it will also increase dependency and belief in this illogical idea that the way to end the war in Colombia is via an intensification of it. The US presence, the new US presence, won't bring Colombia any closer to peace. It will take it further away from it. It won't alleviate the conflict, and the basis we've already seen instead lead to an extreme polarisation of opinions, which is something that will quite clearly hinder the prospects for a negotiated settlement in Colombia. And all serious observers of the situation in Colombia, I think, agree that the settlement, a negotiated settlement, like in Northern Ireland, like in South Africa, and many other places, is the only way out in the end of the Colombian conflict. Late last year, President Uribe tried to calm the uproar over the bases in Latin America by saying that the Colombians have had a military relationship and there's been US military presence in Colombia since 1952, and that this new arrangement was just an extension of what's been going on for many, many years. That's the argument that I referred to right at the start. But President Lula in Brazil responded by pointing out that if the US has been there for so long, since 1952, and still Colombia hasn't managed to solve the problems, it seemed to him that an entirely new strategy needed to be looked at to solve Colombia's problems, and I think that's something that's very true. If all of the US military involvement over the years hasn't been able to, including the very costly plan Colombia, $7 billion, hasn't been able to deal with the problems of the insurgency, with the drugs trade, then obviously I think a new strategy needs to be looked at. And a key component of that strategy needs to be a negotiated political settlement to the conflict, and clearly the basis will not contribute to that. The problem, I think, in moving forward to that negotiated political settlement is unfortunately President Uribe's unwillingness to consider peace talks. When people make efforts to bring the two sides together, the people who facilitate it, he calls them terrorists. When prisoners that the FARC are holding are to be freed, and I think those people need to be freed as a crucial first step to any negotiation process, Uribe does everything that he can to sabotage those releases. And when the international community offers mediation and other assistance, he rejects that. The government line is that the president is interested in peace and the problem's actually the guerrillas. But if you examine the facts, it simply doesn't stand up to any basic examination. And I've talked to people like Gustavo Moncayo, who's the father of a soldier who the FARC are holding prisoner, to Yolanda Betancourt, the mother of Ingrid Betancourt, the famous former hostage, Luis Eladio Perez, who's a senator who was held prisoner by the FARC, who was released a year or so ago. And the message from them is always the same, that this prisoner release, this prisoner exchange, and there have been unilateral prisoner releases recently, that certainly would serve as a first step towards a wider dialogue and wider negotiations, that Uribe is preventing these exchanges and these prisoner releases from moving ahead. So I think that people have to recognise that is a huge part of the problem. Obviously, a peace process isn't going to solve all the problems in Colombia. I think Colombia also needs to work with its neighbours and its friends in the region to build alliances. And this base agreement and what's happened over the last 6 months, 6 to 9 months, has basically antagonised the friends and neighbours that Colombia has in Latin America. The continent has very hard-working people, beautiful and varied climates, very natural resources of all sorts. And working together with his neighbours, the countries, both Colombia and the neighbouring countries, could develop socially, economically. They could tackle issues like climate change, like poverty, and all the other issues that are facing the people of Latin America. So I think the way forward is through regional cooperation, regional integration, not unilateral decisions and confrontational deeds that fundamentally serve to divide people in the continent, as we've seen. The US, obviously, like all countries, naturally acts in its own interests. But I think it's time for the Colombian government to see that the interests that Washington has are not always the same interests that Colombia has. And some people here will know, if you can go back a long time in history, to how Panama was taken away from Colombia and who was behind taking Panama from Colombia. Others would argue that what Colombia wants to do with a third country, a country from outside the region, is nobody else's business. But I think this attitude will mean that Colombia suffers as a nation. The way that the base agreement was handled, the way that neighbours weren't engaged with in any way, it's the worst diplomacy imaginable. It was confrontation rather than cooperation, rather than transparency. And if Colombia treats her neighbours in this way, she'll find herself standing alone on the smaller issues that require the efforts of neighbouring countries. And sometimes, many times in politics, it's better to accept that you have to do things you don't want to in order to maintain relationships that you need. And that's something that I don't think, through his actions, I think it's clear that President Uribe doesn't seem to understand that. And that's why I think for Colombia, this isn't a good deal.
Thank you. I'm going to pass over to Spencer.
I'll try and be brief. I think some of the things that have been said are things I was going to say. I was going to talk, rather than from a big strategic point of view, about actual personal stories of things I found out and people I met when I went to Colombia last year, and especially the human rights record and human rights abuses I personally saw when I was over there. And it's for that reason that I'm concerned about this agreement, which I don't think is going to be in the interest of the Colombians, certainly I met, and the Colombian people generally. From what I've seen over there, I think the army's got a very bad human rights record. As was referenced to the UN report, and there's a large number of extrajudicial killings that the UN refer to, often with the involvement of either the army or paramilitaries. One of the biggest scandals going on at the moment is something called the false positives, where instead of the army shooting people who ostensibly are guerrillas in the jungle, usually poor men have been invited to places for job interviews, then they've been shot by the army, they've been given guerrilla uniforms, bodies have been found, and then they've been said that those people are members of FARC and guerrillas. And that's become a very big concern within Colombia, and there's no doubt, and I think it's accepted generally, that the significant people in the army are implicated in that scandal. But despite that, there's been some investigation, but as I understand it, nobody's yet been charged, and certainly nobody's been prosecuted. for those things. I went and visited a shanty town called Sawatcha, which is in Bogota, where I met some of the families of sons who had been murdered in that way. And what I actually found was some of those women, mothers who were reporting those crimes, they'd also been threatened for reporting them. One woman told me that if she didn't keep quiet, she didn't know where her son is, and he'd been murdered, and he was 16. And that seems to be a major scandal over there, and it's something that, although there's been some investigation, there's not really been any conclusion at all, as far as I can see, and certainly no prosecutions. I also visited a place called Macarena, which is probably about 150, 200 miles south of Bogota, where we went to an army base where, as part of the democratic stability policy that Uribe talks about, where the army goes and takes an area, supposedly gets rid of the FARC, and then tries to go in and put in facilities for the local people. What I found speaking to people over there was that what actually happened, there was large amounts of land had been taken for local people, first of all for the army base and surrounding areas without any explanation. And that led to a lot of people having to move to shanty towns and to urban areas, that a lot of people had disappeared, and nobody knows what happened to them. Lots of relatives of people who were there, and they're no longer there. Nobody knows where they've gone, and there's concerns that they've been executed. We saw directly outside the army base a graveyard with 2,000 unmarked graves in there, with NN written on them, which means unidentified. And the argument from the army was that they were all the guerrillas that they were shooting locally, and there was investigations into every one of those shootings, and that they were going and sending out forensic people to the jungle to see what happened, and there was autopsies of those bodies. And yet the position was that none of those people had been identified at all. Not one of the 2,000 people had been identified, as far as we could work out. The local people had not seen any of those documents, supposedly, that they were there. The story we heard, that the autopsy involved the local grave digger taking some part of the thigh bone of the body, because he thought that that would be a way to try and track DNA, and then the bodies were being buried. And obviously the concern of the local people was that the same people that were being buried were the people who were their relatives who had disappeared. And that was the reality of what they were experiencing day to day. And that, they say, it happened because the army had come and taken over this area. Certainly from what we saw, that there was no facilities we'd seen that had been built during this time at all. And the locals were straightforwardly saying to us that things were a lot less secure now with the army involved and locally there than it had been before the army arrived. So that's certainly a concern I'd have, that if this base agreement goes ahead, what that means is that the American administration is supporting and tacitly accepting the Colombian army, supporting the Colombian army, saying this is an army that we want to do business with, that we're going to go and have operations with, that is accused of carrying out these kind of atrocities without any ostensible investigation at all into those accusations. Certainly from what I saw over there, whether you call it a war on terror or the democratic security policy, as far as the Uribe government's concerned, it's all one. They don't seem to have any distinction between the war on narcotics, the counterinsurgency war that they're operating. They seem to refer to people who are against their regime, trade unionists, human rights activists. They're called guerrillas, they're called terrorists. And then often what happens is, rather than directly the army being involved in their murder or disappearance, it's often paramilitaries who are. And clearly, again, as the UN report says, there's a lot of collusion that appears to be between the government, the army and the paramilitaries. And that, again, is a significant problem within Colombia. And again, if this agreement goes ahead, it doesn't look like that's something that's going to stop. And it looks like the US will then become much more involved with that process. And the same army that's carrying those atrocities out will be the same army that will be dealing with the US Army day-to-day in these counter-narcotic operations that we, I suppose, are going to happen. There does seem to be an impunity for the Colombian army, but the worry, as we heard before, that it would appear that as part of the agreement, there's going to be immunity from prosecution for the US soldiers who are over there as well. And certainly, from as part of Plan Colombia, there's been issues about that. When the base was closed in Ecuador, the Constituent Assembly said that one of the reasons they made that decision was that they'd have over 300 irregular and criminal acts involving US personnel within Ecuador, again where there was immunity from prosecution, and they were talking about things such as a seizure of Ecuadorians, goods, robberies, murders, injuries, paternity cases, and that was one of the reasons that was given for the decision by Ecuador to shut the base there. But there's also been problems around Plan Colombia. In August 2007, there's two US soldiers who working on Plan Colombia mission. They went to a town in Melgar in central Colombia. The allegation is that they kidnapped a 12-year-old girl, that they raped her. There's been no prosecution of those two American soldiers. It was reported in the Colombian press, and the quote is that when the mother of the girl confronted them, that they said that we don't care, they were raped, we're not subject to law over here, the law doesn't affect us. There's recorded in 2006 of 23 cases of sexual violations attributed to Plan Colombia servicemen, and a further 14 in 2007. There's been no prosecutions for any of those. There's another scandal in 2004, some US soldiers and technicians producing pornographic videos that were being sold to adolescents. There's allegations that one investigation that some US soldiers were involved in selling ammunition to the FARC, another occasion to the paramilitaries. And again, there's been no investigation and no prosecutions either in Colombia or in the US about that. So again, that's a very big concern given the impunity and the lack of rule of law that I certainly saw when I was over there involving the army and the paramilitaries. The plan doesn't appear to be supported by US allies. Certainly the UK government has now made it clear that they've got no intention of giving any aid to the Colombian army. Chris Bryant, who's a British Foreign Office and Minister who's responsible for this area, said at UK Parliament that they do not want to provide any aid to the Colombian military, and that's the official UK policy. So if this is going to be a policy that will improve counter-narcotics activities over there, will reduce the amount of cocaine and other drugs that come to Britain, you would imagine that the US government, the UK government, will be very supportive, but doesn't appear to be supportive at all, and specifically doesn't want to support the Colombian military, which I think is quite striking. I mean, by any measure, from the things that I investigated when I was over there, and from I've read into it in terms of homicide rates, disappearances of trade union activists, human rights activists, general civil society activists, it's one of the most, it's certainly one of the most dangerous places to be a trade unionist in the world, and seems to be one of the last countries that a democracy like the US should be involved in terms of militarising further, as opposed to challenging the human rights record that's there now, and getting that dealt with before it decides to invest further in over there. And a final thought is, one of the places I went when I was over there was Buen Pastor, which is a woman's prison. And one of them, they have a specific area of the prison for political prisoners, which by itself is quite a striking thing, since there shouldn't be such a thing. And these were women who had all been charged with what was called rebellion. And a lot of these women were human rights activists or trade unionists who had been involved in organising workers, taking part in strikes. Many of them had been there for years without any charge and any fair process. And even though, and in appalling conditions, the cells that we saw when we were over there, and even though they had all those issues that they could have raised, one of the main thing that they wanted, and they asked the delegation to raise internationally when we came back, is that these bases should not be opened, and they shouldn't be allowed. And for them it was so important, because what they were so concerned about, that it was going to give international legitimacy to the Uribe regime and what the army was doing, and the Democratic Stability Plan, when what they said should be happening is that the outside world should be engaging and being very sceptical and critical of what's happening in terms of the human rights record in Colombia. And they were very deeply concerned that, far from doing that, this was suggesting that America thinks everything's fine in Colombia.
Thank you very much. And I'm going to pass over now to Ambassador Rodriguez to answer some of this.
Thank you very much, Dr. Tania, for this invitation to LSE. I am convinced that a respectful and constructive debate is always positive for the better understanding of issues of interest. However, as you have noticed, this debate is not properly balanced since there are three persons against the Colombia decision, and just me to explain and justify the agreement. In my 15 minutes, I will summarize the main arguments opposing the ones we have heard in the past 45 minutes. In the first instance, I want to clarify the essence of the discussion. This is not about U.S. military bases in Colombia. There have never been, there are no, nor will there ever be U.S. military bases in my country. What we're talking about is the limited access and presence of U.S. military personnel in fully controlled Colombian bases. Colombia has suffered from the lethal combination of drug trafficking and terrorism and is wholeheartedly committed to countering these plights, which go hand in hand with the former financing the latter. The Defense Cooperation Agreement, the full name of this agreement is the Supplemental Agreement for Cooperation and Technical Assistance in Defense and Security between the governments of the United States of America and the Republic of Colombia, along with our own political efforts, are focused in combating these two real enemies. It is the terrorist groups, FARC and ELN, and drug traffickers who should be concerned about the signing of this defense agreement, not our neighbors. It is these illegal groups who are the enemy, not our neighbors or any other nation in the world. Let me emphasize one point before moving on. The FARC and ELN are terrorist groups. Not only have Colombian governments, past and present, classified them as such due to the nature of their terrible acts, but the Council of the European Union in the year 2002 and the United States in the year 1997 have also proscribed them. And as has been evidenced in many occasions, for example, in the huge marches in Bogota and many cities in Colombia in recent years, practically all Colombians reject them and their criminal activities. As UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon stated on December 8, last year, 2009, quote, "In recent years, drug trafficking has emerged as a leading threat to international peace and security. We see this most clearly in Afghanistan, Colombia, and Myanmar, where the production and trafficking of illicit drugs fuels brutal and long-standing insurgencies. But in many other places too, in West Africa, Central Asia, Central America, the Caribbean, and parts of the Mekong region, criminal groups spread violence, fear, and insecurity in their effort to control trafficking routes. First, drug trafficking is evolving into an ever greater threat that is affecting all regions of the world. It will require sustained political will and significant resources to counter this challenge. Second, the transnational nature of the threat means that no country can face it alone. This fight requires a comprehensive international approach based on a strong sense of shared responsibility. States must share intelligence, carry out joint operations, build capacity, and provide mutual legal assistance. So far, cooperation between governments is lagging behind cooperation between organized crime networks." End of quote of Mr. Ban Ki-moon, General Secretary of United Nations. This agreement is a great example of governments assuming the shared responsibility of fighting the illegal drug trade and terrorism. Now let me explain the specifics of the Defense Cooperation Agreement signed between Colombia and the United States on October 30th, 2009. First, I want to explain what it is not, and then second, what it is about. What the Defense Cooperation Agreement is not: it does not permit the creation of a U.S. military base in Colombia. It does not allow U.S. forces to establish 7 military bases on Colombian territory, as is wrongly stated on the flyer for this round table. It is not a mutual defense agreement against any eventual foreign aggression. It has not and will not ever be used as a basis of conflict, as the title of today's event suggests. It will not affect third-party states, as its essence is cooperation. Previous defense and cooperation agreements signed by Colombia have never, ever been used to launch an offensive against a third nation. It will not permit U.S. unilateral operations. Any operation, any single operation, must be previously approved by Colombian authorities. Colombian military personnel will be present and involved at all times in all operations. It will not permit any activities that violates Colombian constitutional laws or international law. It does not in any way or degree affect Colombia's full sovereignty. It will not supersede what is already established in bilateral and multilateral cooperation agreements signed by the parties. This agreement does not imply the transit of international troops. And last, this is not a secret agreement. The full text has been published on both the U.S. and Colombian governmental department websites. Now I will explain what that defense cooperation is really about. It is a bilateral cooperation agreement to strengthen the fight against the traffic of illegal drugs and terrorism. It is an agreement derived from all current bilateral agreements in the matter, as well as the multilateral conventions to which both nations are party. Bilateral U.S.-Colombian engagement in the security sphere is governed by conditions set in a number of bilateral agreements dating back to 1952, as well as various multilateral agreements such as the Vienna Convention, the UN Security Council Resolution 1313, which is to fight against terrorist activities, and the Inter-American Democratic Charter. This is why this defense cooperation agreement did not have to go through Colombia congressional approval. However, in the spirit of transparency and full disclosure, Colombian ministers have discussed and explained this agreement in four congressional sessions. It is an agreement which results from long historical bilateral cooperation and corresponds to a state policy. It is an extension and reorganization of several existing military and cooperation agreements. This is not a new agreement. Rather, it builds on a history of bilateral and multilateral cooperation agreements. At a technical level, the Defense Cooperation Agreement harmonizes and updates existing bilateral agreements, practices and arrangements on security matters, and continues to ensure appropriate protection and status for U.S. personnel. It is an agreement which strengthens the commitment to the fight against illegal drugs through the implementation of multilateral instruments and the interest to promote international cooperation within the framework of shared responsibility. Let's remember that the fight against the illegal drug trade must be a shared responsibility of both producer and consumer countries. It is an agreement which establishes the possibility to broaden regional and global cooperation to counteract the drugs problem, transnational organized crime, terrorism, and arms dealing. We hope to engage other countries in this kind of cooperation agreements. All activities must be authorized and coordinated by the government of Colombia. The activities included in the agreement will be carried out with complete respect for internal laws of each of the parties, the principles of the UN treaty, equal sovereignty, territorial integrity, the non-interference in the internal affairs of other states, and full respect, of course, for the international law. All of this is considered in the agreement explicitly. According to the agreement, the U.S. will be granted limited use and access to some Colombian military bases following very strict security protocol and exclusively for the mutually agreed activities. The presence of U.S. military and associated personnel in Colombia is governed by statute. In October 2004, the U.S. Congress authorized a permanent or temporary assignment of a maximum 800 U.S. military personnel. The cap will continue to be faithfully respected, as in the fact sheet issued by the U.S. State Department on October 30, 2009. Consistent with U.S. policy to nationalize U.S.-supported activities by turning them over to Colombian authorities, U.S. personnel presence will decline in the medium term as progress is achieved in the battle against drug trafficking and terrorism. The agreement establishes specific measures to prevent any violation of Colombian law respecting the immunity that comes with these types of agreements. There will be mutual cooperation and assistance in the development of investigations. On October 11, 2009, in a joint press conference with Colombian Foreign Affairs Minister Jaime Bermudez, U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton summarized the Defense Cooperation Agreement as follows. Quote, "This agreement will allow us to continue working together to meet the challenges posed by narco-traffickers, terrorists, and other illegal armed groups in Colombia. These threats are real, and the United States is committed to supporting the government of Colombia in its efforts to provide security for all of its citizens." Continues Secretary of State Clinton. I want to be clear about what this agreement does and does not do. First, the agreement does not create U.S. bases in Colombia. It does provide the United States access to Colombian bases, but command and control, administration and security will be Colombia's full responsibility. And any U.S. activity will have to be mutually agreed upon in advance. The United States does not have and does not seek bases inside Colombia. Second, there will be no significant permanent increase in the U.S. military presence in Colombia. The congressionally mandated cap on the number of U.S. service members and contractors will remain and will be respected. And third, this agreement does not pertain to other countries. This is about the bilateral cooperation between the United States and Colombia regarding security matters within Colombia. Within Colombia. End of quote. In the fight against drug trafficking and terrorism, Colombia does not just ask for cooperation. We also offer cooperation whenever we can. For example, last week, Colombian Foreign Minister Jaime Bermudez, participated here in London in the conference on Afghanistan, where Colombia committed itself to sending a military mission to fight drug trafficking and terrorism. Colombia is also currently cooperating with many other countries that face similar threats, such as Mexico, Guatemala, Panama, Paraguay, Honduras, Guinea-Bissau, among others. This type of cooperation agreements exist all over the world. For example, the UK has over a dozen of these agreements, including with other European countries. Now let me stress the importance of tackling the illegal drug trade. The fight against the illegal drug trade has to be further strengthened. Despite all the advances made in the eradication of crops and increased number of interdiction operations, consumption, particularly in Europe and in the UK, has increased, unfortunately. The illegal drug trade does not only affect Colombia, but also has grave implications for the health and security of consumer nations. Let me give you an example. A FARC Al-Qaeda link was recently reported in various media, The Independent here in the UK and the Reuters international news agency. To quote from a U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency, DEA, press release, quote, on December 18, 2009, DEA Acting Administrator Michelle Leonard and United States Attorney Preet Bharara announced the arrest of three individuals under the charges of conspiracy to commit acts of narco-terrorism and conspiracy to provide material support to a foreign terrorist organization. The charges stem from the defendant's alleged agreement to transport cocaine through West Africa and to West and North Africa with the intent to support three terrorist organizations, Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, and the Fuerzas Armadas Revolucionarias de Colombia, FARC. All three organizations have been designated by the U.S. United States Department of State as foreign terrorist organizations. End of quote. To conclude, I'd like to quote a couple of President Uribe's statements. Speaking at the United Nations General Assembly on September 23rd last year, quote, our objective with the Defense Cooperation Agreement is exclusively recovering domestic security, never participating in the arms race for the bloody game of international war. Our tradition is one of respect for the global community. And on November 20th, 2009, in a radio interview in Colombia with RCN Radio, quote, the people and government of Colombia do not nor will engage in acts of war. Our goal is to defeat terrorism, never to fight against the international community, nor brother nations. Our fight is against terrorism and for security. We do not have anything against the international community, least of all against the fraternal people of Venezuela. End of quote. One last proof of Colombia's commitment to using this defense cooperation agreement exclusively to combat the drug trafficking and terrorism is the UNASUR. UNASUR is the Union of South American Nations, which was created on December 2004. Joint declaration of August 28th last year, signed by all its members, including Colombia, Argentina, Bolivia, Brazil, Chile, Colombia, Ecuador, Guyana, Paraguay, Peru, Suriname, Uruguay, and Venezuela. Quote, this was signed by the Colombian president. Quote, and all the other presidents of the remaining nations that are part of UNASUR. Quote, recognizing equally that military cooperation agreements must be strictly guided by the principles and intentions of the Charter of the United Nations and the fundamental principles of the Constitutional Treaty of UNASUR, emphasizing that the unconditional respect of sovereignty, integrity, and territorial sanctity of the states, the non-intervention in internal affairs, and the self-determination of the people are essential for the consolidation of regional integration. All UNASUR members decide, including Colombia. President Uribe signed this declaration to reaffirm our commitment to strengthen the fight and cooperation against terrorism and transnational organized crime and its related crimes, narco-trafficking, small and light arms trafficking, in addition to the rejection of the presence or actions of all illegal armed groups, to reaffirm that the presence of foreign military forces cannot, with its means and resources linked to its own goals, threaten the sovereignty and integrity of any South American nation, and as a consequence, the peace and security of the region. To conclude, in summary, the only ones that should really, really be worried with the presence of U.S. military in Colombian bases via the Defense Cooperation Agreement should be the drug traffickers and terrorists. Thank you.
I suggest we're going to do, I'm sure there are quite a few questions arising from the four different presentations. What I thought I'd do is collect two or three questions. If you could state your name and also your affiliation, if you have one, and to who the question is directed, that would be great. Start off over here, Oscar.
Oscar from the International Relations Student. What question for what's your name? Liam, sorry. I do agree on several of your points you said, mainly that there was a communication strategy from the government, not now, but in that moment, to clear what was going on. And the fact that we're still using the name that it's Colombia, it's American bases, shows that in that there was a lack of communication campaign. However, analyzing regional stability, you seem to give full responsibility to Colombia, and I think it's a bit unfair. Countries like Brazil, like other countries of South America have said, we don't agree with the basis, we respect it, but we do not cancel relations, really. We do not close our borders. So how much is there of responsibility in other nations like Venezuela for this instability crisis, taking into account that it was them who closed the border for trade, not the Colombians? Colombia has never closed its trade borders with Venezuela. It has always been Venezuela saying, we open, we close, we open, we close. So how much responsibility is there in other countries and not only in Colombia for the situation?
Okay, thank you. And next to...
Gustavo, Elsie. Actually, I have three commentaries to... But I would love to ask a question to Liam. In spite of your interest and analysis, I would say that you're focusing in the strategic importance of the basis that is overestimated, especially regarding the agreement's potential to destabilize the region. The U.S. has followed a diplomacy of neutrality, and it has mainly supported aid and reduction of poverty and war against drugs, instead of being opposed to leftist governments in order to prevent the enhancement of anterior Americanism in certain countries of the region. Secondly, I would say that your analysis underestimates the unstable climate existing in Venezuela and Ecuador. Chavez has viewed the agreement as a convenient political excuse to promote unity with his already divided military forces, while redirecting public opinion's attention to issues different from Venezuela's critical situations, such as inflation, insecurity, and corruption. And finally, I would say that sometimes in politics, creating alliances with untrustworthy partners leads to insecurity and political weaknesses. Venezuela's position towards FARC has been highly ambiguous, to say the least. In that set of ideas, it's better and more responsible to follow a firm security policy instead of satisfying neighbors' demand. Foreign affairs should be managed under a principle of self-interest and convenient relationships.
Okay. At the back there, and then I'm going to take one more, and then we'll come around for a second round.
I just want to point out that I think that it's not well understood the threats of that Colombia has faced against the EU, particularly it has faced the threat by the extreme left organization, one of the important ones, the extreme left organization, and now it's facing the threat of an external, extremely leftist government in Venezuela, and I think that it would be the case that these spaces are made up as a deterrent to this government to take Colombia. However, I think that the Colombian government should try to explain these ideas to Europe in general. But we cannot try to explain Europe to face that Colombian government as if this is where just a Republican audience, which we have at least a big basic or kind of mining level business. I think that the massive strategy of Colombia should change if it wants to change to show the world in general what are really the problems that Colombia faces. For example, there are important concerns about human rights pointed out by the panel, which were not addressed by the ambassador. And I think that that's really important to address. I don't think that if we talk with Europe as if Europe is still paranoid on a tiny level about terrorism and Al Qaeda, well, this is, we have to change the Atlantic strategy. It has to change because we are no longer in a keep in mind that the world no longer shadows that speak about terrorist threats.
Okay, there's lots more. I'll tell you what we're doing. I mean, does anyone want to... I think there were comments and a couple of questions there, so... Do you want to just respond to the question that was
put? I think
here?
Both of the first two questions were more or less about a similar issue, which was the problem with Venezuela's involvement in all this. But I just want to clarify, I didn't say, and I hope that was clear, that I don't think that Washington's building this base so they can invade other countries. I'm saying that we should be concerned about the potential future if we have Sarah Palin in the White House in 8 years' time. That might be different, whatever assurances they give now. On Venezuela, though, there's obviously been rhetoric on both sides. Chavez accusing Uribe of being a mafioso, and Uribe accusing Chavez of supporting the FARC. So there's been a lot of rhetoric on both sides. But if we look at what the concrete things that have happened, not the accusations that can't be backed up on the whole, but the concrete things that has happened. Colombia is the only country in the region that's invaded its neighbour. They invaded Ecuador without the government's permission. They went after somebody who they were after, legitimate for them to pursue that person in Colombia, but illegitimate for them to go into another person's country without permission. No, Venezuela and Ecuador and Brazil and all the others haven't invaded one another. That's only been Colombia. But also, to try and portray Colombia as the victim. I mean, if you go to these border regions in Ecuador and in Venezuela, you have tens of thousands of displaced people coming across. You have fumigation affecting crops on the other side of the border, Colombian fumigation. You have the drugs trade, the weapons trade. You know, these countries don't have their own internal conflicts, but they do suffer the consequences of the Colombian conflict. So to try and paint them as the victimizers, these countries are at peace. They don't have a war going on. They happen to live next door to a huge conflict, which does have negative consequences on them. So I don't think we can blame those countries for this. They're understandably apprehensive about what's going on just over the border and how it's going to affect them.
Does anyone else want to respond to the comment? Okay, I'm going to take as many as I possibly can. If you can keep your comments as brief as possible, then as many more people can actually... there was one waiting here, and then I'll come to you. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, taking the theme of diplomacy and strategy, and we need to have some idea how they link together. I mean, the US strategy documents could not be clearer. This is from the en route strategy document. It says nothing about the internal situation in Colombia. It is all about en route, means literally en route. Look at the map. It's en route to the rest of Latin America, right? You don't need C-17 massive airlift aeroplanes in order to fight narcotics. It's very clearly part of an international strategy which was developed by the military under Bush, has been implemented by Obama. We shouldn't just be worried about a future president. The honeymoon with Obama is over. He's implementing essentially the Bush doctrine in Latin America, and it is to disarm people who are against US intervention, to not to recognise that. And that's a confusion of diplomacy and strategy. The strategy of the Colombian government is to buy international impunity for its continued human rights attack on the social movement in Colombia. The US is collaborating with that strategy. It's a mutual impunity pact for military intervention on the one hand and human rights violations on the other. If we're concerned about human rights, we should call for the immediate withdrawal of US troops from Colombia and out of Latin America.
Okay. Another comment. Yes, please.
Thank you. Daniel Botero from DLSE, from the Law Department. I am appalled about two issues that are not being mentioned by the second and the third speaker. The first issue is that the second speaker seems to suggest that the Colombian governments have never tried to actually sit down and seriously negotiate with leftist guerrillas, terrorists, whatever you call them, and fails to mention at all that during the government of President Pastrana, there was a very serious effort by the Pastrana government that actually led to the demilitarization of a huge portion of Colombia, arguably a part that was as big as many European nations. And the second issue that is not mentioned by the third speaker is that by far the biggest violator of human rights in Colombia and for many years have been the guerrilla and the Marxist guerrilla. Indeed, there is violation by right-wing paramilitaries, but that has never been the official policy of the Colombian government. What is his view that by far that is the biggest violator of Colombian human rights, and not only rich or bourgeois people, but population in general?
Okay, at the back over there, yes, Marcel. In the middle there, yeah.
I just wanted to say that what Colombia decided to do with the military bases, the other countries did not agree, but this was in a respectful way. Now, talking about Venezuela, I get very passionate on the issue because maybe you guys don't remember when we killed number two in Ecuador, Reyes. A minute of silence. National television. This is a guerrilla man who has proved to manslaughter thousands of people in Colombia. Rich, poor, kidnapped, killed. So why should we comply to make Venezuela pleasant with us, at ease? They nationalize our companies, our private sector. I mean, they celebrate that one person who has caused so much anguish in our country. They celebrate the fact that he lived to create such anguish in our country. And I do understand and I respect the fact that other countries are worried about the U.S. presence, the military presence in Colombia. But why should we blame ourselves for Venezuela changing or for Venezuela being more being more concerned or more upset with Colombia every time Chavez feels that?
Okay. Guy here, and then yeah, you too.
Guy Burton. ideas. Just two quick questions, one internal, one external. Internally, I mean, I'd just be curious to have an idea as to how salient the issue of bases is amongst the Colombian electorate. I mean, is it something that's very important, or is it sort of somewhere further down the list? So that's one thing I'd be curious about. Second thing as well is, in terms of thinking about sort of international relations between countries here, talking about sort of the issue of drugs, I'm kind of curious to get a sense of, you know, to what extent this relationship with the bases is sort of tied into sort of dealing with the drug demand side of things. So to what extent, you know, the US has to become responsible for drug demand. And also with regard to sort of regional cooperation in that regard. So I'll leave that.
Okay. I'm going to take three more questions, and then I'm going to ask the panelists to respond. If we have a few more minutes for other questions afterwards, then I'll open it up. You too, please.
My name is Esteban. I'm a Colombian student here in the UK. First thing, I think it's always very easy to point the finger and, you know, blame this and that. And I think, you know, especially when we're talking about certain issues, I think we should start looking at cleaning up our own house before we go and complain about the rest. However, I do have a couple of questions. One is, why should we expect the US to hold the moral high ground when talking about relations with Colombia? We have seen throughout history that the way their diplomacy works is through pragmatism. They decide to support this or that country depending on their own interests. Their own interests right now are supporting Colombia. So, you know, like, judging whether they have a moral background or not, you know, I don't see much point in it. The second, and it goes back a little bit to a point that was made already, is picking and choosing certain historical facts. They already said that, but for example, Venezuela has also made military deals with Russia, and they're actually very secretive. And no mention of those was made.
Okay, thank you very much.
Just one clarification. My name is Daniel Calderon, I'm studying here at the LSE. About your arguments about unemployment related to this treaty, I think your arguments jump too quickly from one point to the other. I think we are in the worst recession that the world has seen. Venezuela has one of the worst political crises ever. So I think it was pretty convenient for Chavez also to get a high stand here. So I think it doesn't give the full picture. But also for Zimbabwe, I read today in El Tiempo, I think it was El Tiempo today, that is already known, as you said, that the U.S. is going to retrieve some of the monetary help that is given to the Plan Colombia. Yeah, something like that, right? I don't think it goes in the same line as you're trying to sell us, the strategic point of this as fighting the internal conflict and fighting the drugs. Because if it was in that direction, this shouldn't be withdrawn. Okay?
Okay, and just one for this round at the back.
Hi, I'm
a
student at
ISA,
Institute of Study of the Americas, and my question is to the ambassador. You mentioned that the intensification of military operation in Colombia could only have negative impacts on the terrorists. How can you say this when the Colombian army has been linked and has actually committed extrajudicial executions? And furthermore, the reaction of the Colombian state to this has been to accept it to a certain point because the recent soldiers who committed the extrajudicial execution in Soacha have subsequently been released, which is in contrast to human rights defenders, academics, such as Liliana Urbando, who have been imprisoned and kept in prison without trial.
All right, I'm going to ask the panelists to respond to the questions that they want to and those that have been put directly to them. Grace, did you want to say anything?
Well, there are so many questions and a lot of comments, really. Just on Venezuela and Colombia, I think there's been a lot of rhetoric on both sides, and probably Chavez has been more bombastic. That's his style, and I think his comments, especially about preparing for war, were, you know, very ill-considered. But I think we should, not take them too seriously, but just look at things a bit more coolly. I mean, I remember when I was in Venezuela and there'd been some border spat, and then they both got together with Uribe and Chavez and were calling each other brothers. Why are they doing that? They were arguing a minute ago. And then I realised, well, it's in their interest. They're both, Venezuela and Colombia, they're both the second most important trading partners. No one wants Colombia doesn't want a war with Venezuela. Venezuela certainly doesn't want a war with Colombia. They don't, you know, Colombia doesn't want the FARC hiding on the other side of the border. The Venezuelans don't want, you know, the armed conflict spilling over. You know, this. I really think this issue is being overplayed. I know that Chavez is partly responsible because of his language for, you know, ratcheting up the tension, but really I think it will die down again. Just on the broader question of the conflict and the comments we had about the FARC, and I would just comment then that the FARC, for example, are recruiting in schools, and sometimes it's forced recruitment, but more often the people join because, you know, it's a cliche, but poverty is the best recruiting sergeant. They've got no land, their parents have no land, there's no prospect of a job. I mean, there's 12-year-old children joining the FARC. So are we saying the very next day that 12-year-old becomes an international terrorist? Now, I'm not talking saying, right, let's hug a hoodie, hug the FARC, but you need to look at the reasons why people are joining the FARC. I mean, a third of the FARC are minors now, under the age of 18, and why are they joining? Because of the ongoing poverty and lack of prospects in the countryside, and so that's really the questions that we need to address rather than, you know, whether we label them terrorists or not.
Thank you. Liam, did you want to respond?
I'll be quick because I spoke. There's a couple of comments that I thought were interesting. The relationship with demand, that's a key one. Unless demand is addressed, this problem won't be dealt with. Recent studies by the Office of National Drug Control Policy in Washington have suggested that the least efficient, cost-effective way of dealing with drugs is through fumigation and interdiction. It's much, much more cost-effective, I think, 9 or 10 times more cost-effective to deal with demand, to provide treatment for addicts and educate people. Of course, there are many reasons why that policy hasn't been followed, but I think that that's something that more and more people should be talking about, they should be asking about, because I think that is the only way out. And that would obviously not take place in Colombia, which would mean that these bases weren't required, which might make everybody happy. The other thing that I agreed with that was said was the comment at the back. This idea that the only people who shouldn't like these bases are terrorists and drug traffickers is just simply not true. There's a lot of people who think that this will intensify the conflict, that further US military aircraft, that further US soldiers being in Colombia, as I said, will only serve to intensify this war that's going on there, and that's not helpful. Just because people think that don't mean they're a drug trafficker or a terrorist, just means they have a difference of opinion. And Uribe is the comment at the back. The person at the back made her comment. Uribe has this habit of accusing anyone who disagrees with him, a journalist, a politician, an international human rights group like Human Rights Watch, anyone who disagrees with him, he says that they're a terrorist. And that's just not the way you act. A serious politician doesn't do that. David Cameron and Gordon Brown don't like each other, presumably, and they're always saying things to try and make them look better than the other one, but they don't call each other being terrorists, because it's ridiculous. And half of the people that Uribe calls terrorists are ridiculous as well. The whole issue of Venezuela, the confrontational attitude, blaming Venezuela and Chavez for everything, that's not a solution here. The fact of the matter is Colombia geographically is next door to Venezuela, and they have to get on it in some way. Grace made the comment that in the past they fought and then they've made up and they've talked. Ultimately, that's the only way to deal with this problem. They can't not engage. They're extremely important neighbours to one another. And on the economic point, I don't think directly the bases have led to unemployment, but I do know that commerce with Venezuela has decreased massively in recent months because of the problems on the border. And obviously, decreasing commerce is going to create or have some impact on unemployment. The final one, the FARC being the biggest violator of human rights, the only source for that statement is the Colombian government. If you look at Human Rights Watch, the Amnesty International, the UN, I mean, Spencer mentioned 2,000 graves down in La Macarena. The Attorney General, the Fiscalía in Colombia, is looking at another 2,000 cases separate to La Macarena of the army killing civilians. That's not happening. The paramilitaries and the FARC aren't doing that. That's being done by the army. You look at all independent human rights studies on who is responsible for human rights abuses in Colombia, and you will find that overall, it is state or state-backed forces. Something like 75%. Of course, there's certain types of abuses like kidnapping where the FARC perpetrate a lot more than anyone else, But in the cases of things like arbitrary detentions, torture, forced disappearances and extrajudicial executions, it's the other way around. The vast majority are perpetrated by the state. So this statement, it doesn't stand up to any scrutiny whatsoever. Much though, of course, they do violate human rights, and that's something that's totally unacceptable.
What about the mines?
Yeah, they put more down than the army.
One minute. Let the panellists all respond.
If I can respond. I think...
Guys, sorry, but can you let all the panellists respond? I will give you a chance to ask more questions in a second.
Not quite the same point, Liam, but I think a point that's worth making is, however bad the human rights piece are by far, the point of it is the Colombian government's the state. That's the organisation that's supposed to enter in this agreement with the US, not FARC. And that should be held up, and I would hope all Colombians would agree with that, to a much higher standard than something that they call as a terrorist organisation over there. So there should be no extrajudicial killings by the Colombian army. There should be no arbitrary detentions by the Colombian state. There should be no torture by the Colombian state. They've signed international treaties that say so. FARC haven't. FARC are criminals, if that's what the Colombians want to call them, fine. And within the criminal law of Colombia, Colombians can deal with those problems that they've got. To try and say, well, because the terrorists do lots of terrible things, don't you criticise us for doing terrible things, completely and totally misses the point from my point of view. The Uribe regime is ostensibly a democratic, elected government in a state and should be held to a completely different standard to a terrorist organisation. So to that point, a suggestion that perhaps we should get our own house in order before we criticise other people. Human rights are universal for everybody that lives in the planet. You do not get to say, don't have a go at high human rights until your human rights are right. Everybody's human rights need to be protected, and wherever they're violated, here, in Colombia, anywhere else, that needs to be criticised just the same, and always, and forever. And if you don't believe in that, then we'll just have a completely different view about how we're going to engage in the debate. Associated with that, I mean, in Northern Ireland, rightly, there was much more criticism of government involvement in terrorist atrocities over there than there was in what the terrorists are doing, because the government of the people are supposed to be the arbiter of coming up with a decent solution at the end of it. And associated with that, from our Britain's experience in Northern Ireland, the cause of the continuing recruitment for terrorists within Northern Ireland was whether true or not the perception by sections of the community of how they're being treated by the state, of how they're being improperly treated by the state, how they're being attacked and killed by the state. And to me, from when I went to Colombia, that seems to be one of the causes of how FARC have managed to recruit people, is because there is a section of the population, and from the Colombian government's point of view, probably way too big a section of the population, that does feel that their political interests are not being addressed at all, and they feel, rightly or wrongly, that the way that they can have those political things looked at is to be involved in FARC. And that's something that eventually the Colombian government's going to have to come to, as all governments have to come to. And I don't think saying, in the interim, let's have some more men running around with guns in the jungle, is the answer to that at all, whether they're Cumberland, Colombian or American.
Okay. Mr. Master.
Just a few comments in relation to the terrorist attacks of the FARC. In this document, you all can read, you find 607 cases of terrible human rights violations by terrorist attacks of the FARC. And this is just between 2002 and 2008. Just 6 years. The FARC has been going on for 46 years. So it has been hundreds of thousands of Colombians suffering from this nightmare of the terrorist group called the FARC. So let us not allow anybody to distort this idea, trying to present the FARC as freedom fighters or Robin Hoods, because they are not Robin Hoods nor freedom fighters. They are criminals, they are terrorists, they are into narcotraffic, and they have destroyed our country, they have destroyed the economy. They are the real causes for many of Colombia's social problems, for the lack of opportunities for employment of a lot of people, for business to prosper, for citizens to be safe. They are the real ones to blame. This is not to say that, of course, Colombia has to do much more in terms of providing opportunities in terms of land reform, so that people have access to land. Colombia has a lot of things to do, but the first thing we need to solve, because if we don't solve that first issue, we will never go beyond the crisis, is to solve the terrorist and narcotraffic alliance that is destroying our country.
Second, in relation to unemployment, Liam, it's bad. The unemployment went up by more than 1 percentage point last year. It's 11.3%, which is bad news. It's 2.5 million Colombians that don't have employment. And it's bad also in many places in the world because of the world recession. But let's take a look at what happened 8 years ago, before President Uribe came to power. The situation in Colombia was the economy had the worst crisis ever. The GDP dropped by 4.5% in 1990. And unemployment was close to 20%, almost double the rate that we have now. And we have reduced this unemployment rate for more than 8 points in these 8 years. But still, there's a lot of room for improvement, which brings me to the point that I want to emphasize. I'm not here to try to portray the idea that Colombia is a paradise, that Colombia is perfect, that Colombia has solved all of its problems. No, that's not true. Colombia has problems. We have serious problems. We have serious problems with human rights. We have serious problems with poverty. We have serious problems with violence. We have serious problems with corruption. We have serious problems with impunity. And we need all of us, with the support and the help of the international community, we have to continue working hard to solve definitely those problems. But that said, let's see, where was Colombia 8 years ago? Just 8 years ago, we were on the verge of collapse. This was a failing state. Let's see some of the achievements of the government of President Uribe in terms of demobilization, human rights violations. We are all concerned with human rights violations. Not only the journalists, not only the NGOs, not only the universities or the ambassadors. It's all of us, and I fully agree with you that all of us have to be concerned with any single human rights violation anywhere in the world. And we all need to work in the same direction. But let's just give some numbers of what has happened. In the first years of the government of Uribe, 52,000 people were demobilized from illegal armed groups, paramilitaries and guerrilla. 52,000 people. This has no other similar case in the history of the world. There is no other country in which there has been a demobilization of 52,000 people that left their arms because of a decision of the president, because of a law, because of an institutional support to try to pacify our country. Still, we need to progress much more. But 52,000 people demobilized is a huge success. It's something very, very important that one needs to accept and to acknowledge. The murder rates is still very high in Colombia. It's terrible. Colombia is still a violent country, unfortunately. But the murder rates has gone down 54% in the last 8 years. 55%. Show me any other single country in the world that has reduced murder rates by 54% in 6 years. Union leaders and teachers, unfortunately, still, some of them are killed in Colombia. It's terrible. One single death is something that we all have to reject and have to criticize, and we have to press the government and the authorities to make sure that this doesn't happen in Colombia or anywhere else. But those crimes have gone down by 87% and 85% in the last 8 years. So we made a lot of progress. We've come a long way. We still need to improve more, but we have to understand where we were 8 years ago. And we need the support and the help and the understanding and the cooperation from everybody to continue to complete the task. It's not complete, but we've made a very significant progress. And the last, kidnappings. Kidnappings have come down by 93%. 93%. Still, we have a very high number of kidnappings, more than 300 kidnappings in Colombia. That's terrible. 300 kidnappings, almost one kidnapping per day. It's a bad situation. But it was close to 4,000 just one decade ago. That was a real nightmare. So to make this progress has been a very difficult effort. This is not to say that the government has made mistakes. Of course, the government has made mistakes. And there are several terrible things happening, not with the acceptance of the government, But as you mentioned, the extrajudicial execution, that's something absolutely terrible that one has to condemn, and the government has condemned. Those soldiers, let me complete my idea, those soldiers were on trial, unfortunately, due to some legal formalisms, they went out of trial. President Uribe himself was the first to say that that situation was completely unacceptable, and they are again going to process, are again going to take to trial all these soldiers. And these soldiers have been isolated from the rest of the army. They are not part of the army as of today, because the Colombian state is resolved to make sure that justice is properly done in Colombia, because we need to solve those cases. It's terrible to have extrajudicial executions. There is no justification for violence, either from the terrorist groups of the FARC or the paramilitaries, from wherever it comes, there's no justification. And of course, the state and the government has the obligation to avoid these things happening and to make sure that the justice occurs. In Colombia, for the future, to really pacify the country, the key issue has to be impunity, the fight against impunity, to make sure that justice is properly applied in Colombia. But there has been a significant improvement also in that sense, in terms of the fight against impunity. And finally, just some other statistics. The displacement, which is a big problem that Colombia has come down from the year 2000 into annual displacement of people due to violence, to these problems that we have mentioned. The displacement has come down 75% in just 6 years. So, I mean, we have still many things to worry about in Colombia, but we have to accept and acknowledge that there has been a significant progress, significant improvement in the situation of Colombia, and what we have to do is to concentrate our efforts and our commitments to make sure that the rest of the task is completed. Last point about the drug demands, your point. This U.S. military personnel presence in the Colombian bases is part of the fight against the production and trade of drugs. But if there is no similar effort, or even much higher effort, on that demand side, I fully agree with Liam. In my opinion, through education, even more than through criminalization, but even though I do believe that we need to have both the stick and the carrot, but we need to work on that demand side as well, a lot, in the UK, in the US. In Colombia, there is not a consumption problem of in Colombia, it's marginal. The production in Colombia is huge for the rest of the world, not for domestic consumption. So as long as there is consumption in the US, in Europe, in the rest of the countries, we will have this problem, in Colombia or anywhere else. And in Colombia, it has the double complication of being narcotraffic, the principal financing source of terrorism, of the terrorism of the FARC. And that's why we have that problem. But you're absolutely right, we need to work on the demand side. If we don't do that, it's going to be very difficult to solve the problem.
Okay, we've already run over time, but I'm conscious that a lot of people want to speak, and I think some of the panel would like to actually come back a little bit on some of the comments.
I just wanted to make one second.
One second point, and then I'm going to...
The statistics that were given are statistics from the Colombian government. They don't match with statistics from independent human rights sources. They don't match up at all. There has certainly been decreases, for example, in kidnapping, but other things, 2008 saw a 25% increase in trade unionists being killed, according to the Colombian trade unions. So the statistics here are open to debate, I think, which is not a debate I want to go into right now.
Okay, are you happy for just a few more comments? Okay, I'm going to take five and then we're all going home. Over there.
I've got a comment and a question for the panel. Two former presidents have been from Brazil and for Uruguay, and now two candidates for the presidential election in Peru. I say that they will
legalize
drugs, especially the soft drugs. I don't know if you, your country, could take this policy in the future the agreement with Americans doesn't work.
Okay, other comments? You've had one here at the front.
My name's Lucy Craig. I've visited your beautiful country a couple of times in my life, but I'm neither a student, an academic, nor a historian. The gentleman behind me picked up on one of the questions I was going to ask you, and that's about the other strategies help by the Colombian government for dealing with the issues of terrorism? Looking back to a former part of my life, the Americans were completely disastrous in Vietnam. You can't win the hearts and minds of people by bombing them from 30,000 feet, and I don't think military means deal with the problems of terrorism. I'd like to know what your government is doing about things that were mentioned, like land reform and looking at the upstream problem. What is it that creates people who give up their lives to go and live in a jungle and live with a gun rather than live with their families and living the life that most of us like to live? The other question is, of course, the issue of drugs. As the foremost producing country in the world, almost, what does your government think about leading an international effort to decriminalize drugs, take away the market? You're still left for a long time with the problems and the sadness of the drugs the effect that drugs have on people, but at least you'd be taking out those in your country, in this country, in the States, who are making vast millions out of other people's deaths.
Okay, the two at the back, two hands here.
This is for the ambassador. First of all, I'm surprised with the information you got about displacement. We're still the second country in the world with more displaced people, Sudan. And secondly, the difference between the sources in relation to displacement is because the government started measuring it very lately after COVID started measuring it many years before. My question to go to point is the following. You were talking very clearly about the fight on terrorism and the fight on illegal drugs, but you were completely silent in relation to the paramilitary people that have been proved internationally to be linked to drug business and more directly to the amazing amount of mass graves along the country, more than 2,000. Mass graves have been found in the country. And last year, it was found in Norte de Santander that two ovens were used by the paramilitary people to destroy the evidence of the corpses of the people that they were disappearing. And that has direct relation with the paramilitary relation with the army and the government. So you didn't mention anything in relation to drug linkage to that and to the idea of security, which I'm sure it has to do also with the right of the victims to truth and to know what's going to happen with the perpetrators of it. And the last thing is that it is well known internationally that the demobilization process was a kind of a joke, because 2 years afterwards they discovered that many of the people that had dismobilized remobilized again and actually have been recognized by the government. And it has been recognized by the UN, and it has been recognized by the Commission for Human Rights.
Okay, I said five, so we've got two more left. One, very quick.
I'm a student here at Development Management at UCL, and I just had a question referring back to the initial debate on the marriage basis in Colombia. And I just wondered whether Colombia had come up with any policies to prevent that US presence in Colombia was across the line of the initial military agreement, which is that of combating drug trafficking and terrorism, since this debate has evidently emerged in Colombia since last month. And I was just wondering whether you have been dealing with the issue, either formally or informally, to avoid this problem and create any action.
Okay, final question. No one. Oh, okay. Sorry, you've asked one.
Contrary to what the ambassador said at the beginning, I think that it's not you and the other people with a point of view. I think that your point of view is endorsed by others in the room. So my invitation for you not to feel by alone in this discussion. That's one thing. The second thing is that I think that all these issues on human rights and all that, they become, you know, as you can see, we can clearly see that this is a Colombian discussion because we're very passionate about it. And we sort of tend to throw in just everything into the pot, things that are not exactly related with the basis discussion. So that's number two. And number three is, I don't know if the panelists what would you say, but this seems to me as an issue that was raised solely by the Venezuelan government, and he is AD governments in the region. And as we start seeing a shift in this decade towards more central to right-wing governments, such as in Chile, we're going to see it in Brazil, we're going to see it in Argentina, don't you think that the relevance of the topic is just going to fade down during the next decade, which is the term of duration of the agreement? Not only that, but someone asked there about the relevance for the electorate of this topic. And at least from my point of view, from the Colombian point of view, and I'm speaking about myself, I think it's fairly irrelevant topic when casting our votes in any elections. And I think that it is a fairly irrelevant topic in the rest of Latin America. So I don't know if you would agree with me that the topic of the basis is just going to fade away in time, and pretty much it's just going to be an anecdote in the history of our political external relations.
As a historian, I'll probably be the one who studies it. I'm going to give just 2 minutes just to sum up. I think it's been a long evening. We've had a lot of discussion. I'm very grateful for all the comments and for the panelists for all their interventions. Grace, would you like any time to say anything?
Just on the question of drugs, I mean, I totally agree with everyone on the panel and others who've said that it's the question of demand, and the demand comes from the West, and the West bears a lot of, you know, Europe and the US bears a lot of responsibility. I think legalization on the whole would be a good thing, because it would take a lot of control away from violent armed groups, but I don't think that would solve all the problems in Colombia, apart from, you know, that the state doesn't even control all the territory. But certainly I think the practice of spraying herbicides on coca farms is totally counterproductive. It's causing horrible human illnesses, environmental damage, and it's actually, and the people whose land is being sprayed, is actually turning them against the government and sometimes into the arms of the FARC. And so I think that's a totally counterproductive policy. I had to say something about something else, but it slipped my mind at the moment. Basically, just coming back on what the ambassador said, that I do understand that in Colombia there's a real thirst. I understand why Uribe is popular, because he said he was going to reassert the authority of the state, stop all this violence, and in certain ways, you know, he's made the country more secure. He's secured the highways and the cities and so on. But if you do that on the basis of allowing the armed forces to get away with human rights abuses, particularly in the countryside, you're going to perpetuate the causes of the crisis. So if they go into areas, they assume that everyone are FARC supporters, they, you know, arbitrarily arrest hundreds of thousands of people without trial and so on, if they continue to tolerate paramilitaries and so on, it isn't a solution to the problem. So I don't think you can counterpose the two, saying, right, first we'll get rid of the terrorist problem and then we'll solve everything else. You do need to, it has to be, yeah, and that question of impunity, which you raised yourself, has to be addressed.
Liam.
Briefly on the about it being Venezuela principally and its allies that complained about the basis. It wasn't just Venezuela. Brazil complained about it, Chile complained about it, Argentina complained about it. Even as I said, I think in my presentation, Alan Garcia in Peru said he was very concerned about it. So it was a much broader thing than that. But I do agree with you 100% that this isn't in Colombia, which some people here may not be familiar with. It's not a big issue for the electorate. I do think, however, that the conflict is a big issue for the electorate, especially the millions of displaced Colombians. And this base agreement will certainly impact on the conflict in many different ways. So indirectly, it certainly is a big issue for the Colombian population. The last one, this issue of the terrorist problem keeps coming up, and the human rights abuses. I said it earlier on, and I think it's something, it's sad that it hasn't come up. People need to be thinking about how to move forward to a negotiated settlement of the Colombian conflict. In the end, the British government sat down with the IRA, and the IRA used to put bombs in this city where we're sitting today. In the end, the white South Africans and black South Africans sat down, even though the black South Africans under Nelson Mandela had put bombs all over South Africa, and the white South Africans, obviously, as we know, treated black South Africans very badly. So in the end, these people overcame these divisions, and that's the only way out of this for Colombia. It's an absolute myth to think, as somebody said, that you, by bombing from 30,000 feet, you're going to solve this issue, whether it's drugs, FARC, or paramilitaries, or human rights abuses. It's not the way to do it. It's obvious, it's logical that's not the way to do it, and I think it's very sad that debate isn't more prominent both within Colombia and internationally? Because I think that's the debate that needs to be had.
Thank you very much,
Ben. I think that I was going to, a lot of what Liam said, I think is what I was going to say. Certainly from my experience when I went to Colombia, the issues of the army intervening in particular areas and the locals would say taking land, redistributing land is a key issue that they talk about that's part of the security policy there, and that's causing real grievances over there within those rural communities, and that seems to me being one of the issues why people are there either prepared to either directly join FARC or tacitly support FARC or other organisations, which then means that Uribe and the regime will say that, well, these people are also terrorists, so we need more army, and it goes round and round and round and round, and it's clearly not, it's just not being solved. You go to Bogota, beautiful city, there's more armed soldiers than will be in London, but apart from that, you wouldn't know that there was any kind of conflict. I think that would be a fair thing to say. Peaceful city's got crime, but so does London. So when you go there, it's a peaceful, well-ordered city, and if you live in Bogota, especially if you have some money, you can see why you're going to be quite happy with Uribe and think that things have improved for the better. You fly to someone like Macarena, it is a different country, completely different country. And the problem is that all the people who join FARC, or it appears to be, are coming from places like La Macarena. They're not coming from Bogota. And there's no doubt that by having yet more soldiers there, it's going to one of the root causes of the conflict in the first place, and it will simply perpetuate the conflict. And that's really why I think that this is a bad idea, much more than, I don't think there's any suggestion anybody's going to invade Venezuela at any stage. I just think that it's going to intensify the conflict. It's going to be another thing that's going to have to be negotiated away when, as Liam says, they eventually sit down. It's another thing that the FARC side, the left-wing side, whatever you call them, are going to say, as part of the settlement, you must shut these bases. And suddenly you've got the international relations between Colombia and the US, another hurdle that the Colombian government's eventually going to have to jump. And it's just making things more complicated than they already are.
20 years ago, Colombia had a successful peace process. We had a guerrilla called M19. It was quite strong. And we entered into negotiations after a long fight between the army and the guerrillas. And this peace process has been very successful. All of them demobilized, they reincorporated into civil society, into politics. Many of them became senators, became governors, city mayors. The last two city mayors of Bogota, the second most important political job in Colombia, to be city mayor of the capital of Colombia, belonged to the Polo Democratico Party, which was born out of this peace process with M19. So Colombia does have a tradition, a successful tradition, of being able to solve these differences, these conflicts. The problem with the FARC, as opposed to what happened with the M19, is that the FARC insists in fighting. President Uribe has made many calls to the guerrilla to demonstrate their willingness to stop fighting, to stop violence, and to sit down and have a negotiation. President Pastrana, as you correctly mentioned, made huge sacrifices, huge efforts, demobilizing a huge territory for several years, making all kinds of concessions, until the FARC proved that they did not really have a willingness to reach a peace agreement. So you need two parties there. And the FARC, unfortunately, different from M19, has not shown that interest, not a minimum interest in engaging into a conversation. But I do hope that one day they change their attitude and they accept again the offer to have a peace negotiation process, because that's much better solution, of course. We can save many lives, we can save a lot of time, we can use the money instead of fighting for social investment, etc., etc. So I fully agree, and we have a good example. And hopefully the FARC one day will realize what M19 realized, that it's not fighting the best way of changing Colombia, but getting into politics, into a democracy, and winning those jobs. City mayors, congressmen, ministers, governors, and they've done quite well. They have 20% of the total votes of Colombia, this former guerrilla group. So there's a good history there, and I hope it repeats if the FARC changes their attitude, starting with getting away from narcotraffic. That's one of the worst things that happened to FARC. The FARC has become a narcotraffic group. But that's a discussion for another day. In relation to your comment about the paramilitaries, the Colombian government and I personally condemn all kinds of illegal armed groups, FARC, ELN, paramilitaries, whatever you name them, from right, center, or left. There is absolutely no justification for any kind of violence. The paramilitaries had to come to fight guerrillas because, and then you can justify. No, I don't justify paramilitaries either. The paramilitaries are as criminals and as terrorists and as negative for Colombia as guerrillas. And we have to solve the problem of violence coming from the whole spectrum of a political space in Colombia. And the last, about the failure of the demobilization, you mentioned that some of the, or a lot of the demobilized persons went back into crime. Unfortunately, that's partially true. 3,000 out of the 52,000 have gone back into criminal gangs. They're called the BACRIM. They are not paramilitary groups. They are not new paramilitary versions of what we had 5 or 10 years ago. Unfortunately, they've gone again into crime, basically narcotrafficking. And it's 3,000. It's a lot, and it's terrible. It's bad news. For example, they're creating a lot of violence in Medellin in these days. But there are 49,000, 90% plus of the people that have actually demobilized are in this moment receiving education, receiving assistance to their families, receiving vocational training for work, and receiving support from the state. More than $100 million per year are invested in the reincorporation into society of these persons. And the last point I wanted to mention is about the legalization. Nobel Prize, Economics Nobel Prize, Milton Friedman has said that legalization is the solution. The Economist, the wonderful British magazine, has for many years argued that the legalization is the only solution. Distinguished former presidents of Latin America have mentioned that that's the only possibility. And I think that the world, sooner or later, will have to sit down and discuss. All of the countries will have to agree. One country unilaterally cannot decide to legalize the drug production and trade. It will have to be part of an international consensus agreement solution. And as long as we don't have that consensus, we will have to continue fighting on the production and consumption. But I think your point is valid. We need to consider other alternatives because this war is very costly and it's very destructive for everybody. And maybe we need to change the approach. But as long as there's no consensus, it's impossible to legalize or decriminalize the drugs in the world. And the last, in relation to the social issues in Colombia, there has been reduction in poverty and extreme poverty in Colombia as well. That's another good statistic. We still have a lot of people under poverty lines, and we need to get them out of poverty. And I agree with your comments in relation to the need. One key issue that has not been properly addressed in Colombia is the issue of land reform. We have a problem with land reform. We have to recognize that problem. We have solved many other problems. We have so many problems that to solve all of them in 5 or 6 years, it's impossible. But first in the agenda, in the priority, in my opinion, my personal opinion, is the issue of land reform. That's a very good way, a very efficient tool to allow social progress in Colombia. And we need to do much more on that issue.